Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 7th day of April, 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. If you can stay with us for the whole of the hour, you'll hear Commodity Week, including our guest, John Bondurant. It was a great conversation with John and Dan Zwicker and Chuck Shelby. And at the end of the first half, hour, we'll take up the weather forecast too. That with Eric Snodgrass from Agrible right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Here's the way the numbers finished up in Chicago for this Friday afternoon. May, corn down a penny and a quarter at $3.59 and a half. July at $3.67 at a quarter, penny and a quarter lower. September, corn down a penny and a half at $3.74 and three quarters. And December at $3.84 and a half, down 1 and a half cents. The March of next year, penny and a half lower at $3.93 and a half. May, beans up a half at $9.42. July, $9.53 and a quarter, a half higher. The August unchanged at $9.54 and three quarters. And November beans at $9.49 and a half, down 1 and a quarter cents. January, a penny lower at $9.55 and three quarters in the soybeans. Soybean oil, $31.62, up 25 cents. Bean meal at $3.07.40, down $1.30. May wheat for the soft red at $4.24, three quarters of a cent higher. July, the harvest month, up a quarter at $4.36 and a quarter. And the hard red July at $4.34 and a quarter, 1 and a quarter cents higher. Live cattle futures in Chicago finished the April contract at $120 and nickel, that's $1.25 higher. June at $111.80, up $1.67 and a half cents. That for the live cattle, 100 pounds, of course. Feeder cattle, April contract at $133.75, $1.80 higher. And the May futures up $1.70 at $133.87 and a half cents. Lean hogs, April's down 60 at $63.32 and a half cents. The May at $69 even finished 55 cents lower. Hey, have you decided to join the Wilt team for our marathon? That's coming up Wednesday. 26.2 hours of fundraising, looking for $100,000. Sure could use your help. You can go right now to willag.org and then to the homepage, or just go to willpledge.org and get us a good start.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Well, here are some of the other numbers as they're trading this afternoon. May crude oil at $52.17 a barrel, 47 cents higher. Ethanol futures up 2.5 cents at $1.63 and a half. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $1.62 and 7 tenths is 1 penny and 4 tenths higher. Gasoline up 1.5 cents at $1.74 and a half. And natural gas for the day at $3.26 and 2 tenths of a cent, down 6 and 9 tenths of a cent. The Dow about 57 points higher at 27,660. The U.S. dollar at 101.18. That's up 0.61 for the afternoon. Gold futures 70 cents higher at $1,251. The weather forecast says this evening we'll have a few clouds out there. It'll drop to a low of 37 on a southwest wind at 5 to 10. Tomorrow, sunny skies, a high of 69. Winds out of the south at 15 to 25. And Saturday, mainly clear skies, a low of 53. Sunday, partly cloudy. It'll be windy on Sunday with a high of 77 degrees. The south winds at 25 to 35 miles an hour. Sunday evening, windy, mostly cloudy skies, a low of 61. On Monday, windy again, a few thunderstorms, maybe a tenth of an inch of rainfall. And Monday will have a 60% chance of rain. It will go to a high of 73. Monday night, a few clouds, a low of 47. Winds on Monday evening out of the west-southwest at 15 to 25 miles an hour. As we make our way into Tuesday, partly cloudy skies and 61, partly cloudy, and then mostly sunny skies on Wednesday and 64 degrees. More on the weather in a few minutes.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Thanks for being along with us today. We're now joined by Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting in Atchison, Kansas. The skies are blue, and it is gorgeous here today. How about where you are?
It's starting to really come around, Todd. We still have quite a bit of excess moisture. I think we ended up getting here in Atchison about 6 inches of rain, and in the area, probably around 4.5 to 6 inches. So we were on the top end, but starting to climb in the temperatures. And I think more and more people that I talk to, especially east of the Mississippi River, are getting itching to get out there and get some planting done. I think Western Illinois is talking about doing some stuff early next week. A client near Owensboro, Kentucky, thought that we'd be able to see some movement this weekend on the lighter ground. So it's starting to be that time of year, I think.
Absolutely. I wondered what you thought about the week's trade. We've had a whole week now to absorb the USDA prospective plantings and grain stocks numbers. And I don't know, the trade was, what would you think about it for the week?
Well, it's still a heavy supply trade mindset. And I think when you look at that and then at the end of the week and you look at the technicals and the fact that we really had kind of a technical breakdown after Monday's challenge of resistance levels led by the corn, which was set up by the end of the week, end of the month, end of the quarter trade, after that acreage and stocks report, those numbers were digested. And so when we lost the technicals, I think the trade went back to a heavier supply mindset. And I don't think that the President Trump and President Jinping meeting really did a lot of good either, because from the people I talked to in Chicago, the mindset was more of a fear that it could become confrontational and wouldn't be unlike what we dealt with the Mexico issue about 3 weeks ago, when President Trump was, exchanging rhetoric back and forth. Fortunately, that hasn't happened so far, but I think the trade was just on notice and worried about that.
Yeah, that came after the fact normally, and so we've got some time to wait it out, I suppose, at this time to see what the president felt about his meeting at Mar-a-Lago with the president of China. More to come over the weekend. Yes, that's normally when he decides to tweet out, the president of the United States, that is.
Right.
In Chicago, was there any reaction to last night's events in the Mideast?
I think so. I think that the trade in the grains, and again, referencing back to what we've seen, a familiar theme, if you ask me, Todd, that once we had President Trump elected, certain commodity sectors moved up sharply. Once we had the Federal Reserve change their monetary policy to a tightening and improving global economy, we had certain commodity sectors move higher. And again, as we see these kind of black swan events of the Syrian airfield bombing get into the news, we see once again gold and crude oil take the brunt of the positive news and commodities. But on all of those scenarios, almost all of them, except for maybe the Federal Reserve policy, the dollars also tried to rally. And so I think the grains essentially walk away with the idea that, okay, this is going to do more harm in global trade than it will do good. And I have to say, not that I'm pretty contrarian to begin with, but I feel a little bit contrarian about this, because I kind of feel like the last 8 to 10 years, we've kind of given up some of our Middle Eastern wheat businesses, especially because in part of our foreign policy and because of our decision to not be at the forefront of what is going on in the Middle East, as far as being kind of the best term you could use. I don't know if it's the right one, but the world's policeman, for lack of a better term. I'm encouraged that maybe we will see a little bit more reaction, that we will be at the top of the list now for some wheat business from countries like Jordan and like Iraq and like Egypt, even with some favorable comments coming from many of those states and countries this week after that attack. And so I think in a nutshell, I don't think the trade's ready to buy into that yet. I think they're still very nervous that anything like this is going to slow down global trade. It's going to create a safe haven buying environment for the U.S. dollar, and clearly we have to watch that.
And historically, just for reference, the United States was a supplier in the Mideast, and then they moved to the Black Sea area, Russia, Ukraine. And you're thinking maybe that there might be a better relationship that would open up more wheat sales in that part of the world. I want to come back to last night and the jump in the price of crude oil. It was a nice jump last night, but it extends kind of a crude oil rally that's been happening. Is that good for the commodity markets in general?
I would say yes, if it doesn't get above $55 a barrel, because we again saw the Baker Hughes rig numbers go up again. I think we're up something like 380 rigs since the major lows were made early last year in the crude oil market. You don't want the price of crude oil to go up too fast, too much too fast, in my opinion, because it not only is it going to encourage more production and more of those offshore supplies that are sitting in tankers on some of these major ocean ports. But you're also going to, you know, probably start to slow down the demand side quite a bit. And I think one of the biggest negative features to the trade probably this week when it came to the demand side of the equation was the fact that we weren't really utilizing the crude and the unleaded and the distillates like we should be, given the prices and given the supplies. And that, you know, on the weekly energy numbers when it came out on Wednesday was a bit of a negative fundamental to me. But if you look at the demand overall, and this is where I think the positive demand news by and large in the grain market is once again being mostly overlooked. And I think that's going to be the case until we see Tuesday's USDA numbers for South America. But to answer your question very directly, the crude oil market needs to stay below $55 a barrel so that we can keep a very strong demand base. And crude oil and corn have shown some very strong demand here in the last, you know, 9 to 12 months. And we need to keep that demand going. That's at the heart of why we don't want to see any apparent trade disruptions at all, because that's the one thing that I think is keeping the market underpinned very nicely, and that's the demand side.
You mentioned that the WASD is coming out next week. That's going to push me towards the soybeans. You also mentioned South America. I want to know if you think that producers in Iowa, Minnesota, the Dakotas, Kansas, who all up their production acreage for soybeans on the prospective plantings report, have made enough sales ahead of time. And have they been calling and saying, do I need to make more sales even at this level?
Yeah, in those regions, no, they have not. The basis levels have really never gotten to the price levels that they have wanted them to get to. And out here, as I've been out here 4 years now, I've come to realize that many commercials just outright won't do hedge to arrives in the soybeans, especially for new crop futures. And if they do, they charge quite a bit of a fee to do those. And so, no, I don't think you have what you need hedged if you're in the producer's minds right now in the Western corn and bean belt. Yes, there's been a lot of calls this week about, do I need to sell into this market? My personal opinion is no. I think the 935 level has held. The 307 meal level held on the close today. We did go below it during the middle part of the session when we had, I think it was AgriRural came out again with another update. They went from 107 million tons in beans to almost 112 million tons, and they kept their summer corn crop. Well, they went up about just under a million tons from 29.3 to 30.2 on their first crop, and that tended to really hit the market in the short term. But I think this 935 level is a support level, 307, 305 in the meals a support level. And then Tuesday, if the USDA doesn't move up as much and doesn't go towards that 112, 113 production number in beans, it might actually bring in some short covering. And if it does, I've, you know, recommended to clients and producers that have called in to get some more sales made, that as you get back to 975, 980 November beans, start really getting ready to sell again. It's going to be hard to get above 10 bucks, especially if these kind of acres are planted this spring.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Mike Zuzulos with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. In today's agricultural news, House Agriculture Chairman Mike Conaway, a Republican from Texas, now faces the daunting task of handling one of the most important responsibilities in agriculture, crafting a new farm bill, while at the same time leading the politically sensitive House Intelligence Committee probe into the Russian meddling in last year's election. Conaway got the House Ag off to a fast start, fortunately, in digging into the farm bill. He set a demanding schedule for the panel's subcommittees, requiring each to hold two hearings over March and April to determine potential changes to the farm bill when its reauthorization comes due next year. That call put the House Ag committees well ahead of where they need to be in setting up staff and the subcommittees into a place that they can hash out the legislation. So now there appears to be little worry about the chairman's new assignment. The committee said in a statement that Conaway would take the increased workload in stride, but things could get tough if congressional leaders target the farm bill for big cuts, and the Russia investigation still requires much of his attention next spring when the final details of the authorization need to be nailed down. Cuts would mean tough decisions and likely drawn-out negotiations for Agriculture Committee leaders, and handling those time-consuming talks while overseeing a top-of-the-news probe that could affect the White House would be quite a feat of Capitol Hill multitasking. We'll hear more about one of those subcommittees, this one on taxes, a bit later in our program today. Well, let's stay in Washington, D.C., but we'll move to trade. When the plans were first drawn up to begin construction on five new pork processing plants in Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, and Missouri, potentially creating nearly 2,000 new jobs, talks were well underway for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The completion of the 12-country deal seemed likely, promising to reduce tariffs and generate big new trade-related sales in Asia for the industry. But now, as those plants begin to come online, the industry is starting to sweat a potential pork glut. Nobody built a plant, nobody expanded solely on that, but it was one of those things that was another positive for the industry, assuming that we were going to get the TPP passed, says Ken Mashoff. He's the president of the National Pork Producers Council and a pork producer right here in the state of Illinois. We had a president who said he would sign it. We basically were sitting on a Congress that we thought was going to adopt this, and we are where we are now. Trade was a top priority when NPPC held its fly-in Wednesday in Washington, D.C., and U.S. pork producers support a bilateral deal with Japan. The group's leaders made clear Japan, which Vice President Mike Pence and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross will visit when he heads to Asia in less than 2 weeks, already represents U.S. pork's largest buyer, $1.56 billion last year. But the European Union, the U.S. pork industry's biggest trade nemesis, has been talking about an FTA with Japan since 2013, and it held its 17th negotiating round in September. And Japan has suggested it would leave agriculture out of its first economic dialogue with the United States, hoping this would give it more leeway in parallel talks with the European Union. And finally today, something a little different. The National Agricultural Aviation Association wants to remind farmers using drones on their operations this year to remember to keep an eye out for agricultural aircraft flying low over their fields. Agricultural aviators often fly as low as 10 feet off the ground, and this year may find themselves in the same airspace as drones that are licensed to fly as high as 400 feet. That's why the National Ag Aviation Association is urging farmers to do what they can to watch out for the larger aircraft. Executive Director Andrew Moore says when flying at speeds over 140 miles an hour, agricultural aviators likely won't see a UAV. That's why it's so important for drone operators to protect aviators any way they can. In tests conducted by the Colorado Agricultural Aviators Association and the state of Colorado, not one pilot could continually track a 28-inch drone while flying at regular speeds. They may be spotted for a second, but won't be continually seen, so it's up to the drone operators to prevent potential collisions. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, joined on this Friday afternoon by Eric Snodgrass. He's from Agrible. Hey, Eric, thanks for being with us. I hope you made it through the wetter week. Pretty unhurt this week.
Well, unfortunately, I did not. I came home on Wednesday night from a talk I was given in Nebraska about the upcoming growing season and walked downstairs and had an inch of water in the basement. So I spent all last night tearing out carpet. So, you know, this rain's been great for agriculture, but not so great for my basement. And I'll tell you something, Todd. The last couple of weeks, we've really been lit up with both severe weather and with quite a bit of rain. In fact, the Central Plains over the last 14 days, a lot of places better than 2 inches, and that's great. We actually got the latest drought monitor came out yesterday, and the good news is we've seen a class improvement in the drought there. But I'll tell you this, that drought monitor is produced on Tuesday mornings, and it's released to the public on Thursday. So the thing is that all of that rain we got on Wednesday has not even been reflected in the latest drought monitor, so you can continue to see some relief. But I'll tell you, a lot of farmers I talk to, they're wanting to know, when are they going to be able to get in the fields? When is it going to get that longer, more extended, drier period where they can get a lot of field work done? So let's talk about that short-term forecast. Basically, the system that moved from the plains through the southeast is now in the northeastern United States. It took a while to get there, and along the way did a lot of severe weather. But basically, the backside of that low is what's keeping us kind of cool right now. In fact, overnight tonight into tomorrow morning, there's frost and freeze warnings actually for the Ohio River Valley. So that's substantial for this time of year. But we got a big warm-up coming. High pressure system kind of builds over the southeast, which means that we're going to be getting some southerly flow where we are here in Illinois. But it's going to be very windy this weekend. Now that'll dry things out, but it's going to push our temperatures up into the upper 60s and 70s. The thing I'm watching though is Sunday. There's another low pressure system forming in the northern plains. That's going to bring some rain to South Dakota and Minnesota and Iowa, which honestly have missed out on a lot of the recent precipitation. But the upper level support for this system is just not there for it to do too much in terms of blanketing the corn belt with rain again. What I mean here is that the jet stream's just flattened out and kind of slowing down, and that really prevents these systems from getting strong. But there is going to be a storm threat to our west, think Iowa, Minnesota, parts of Missouri on Sunday, and that will translate to the east on Monday to Illinois and Indiana. But right now, things are just not looking, as though it's going to be another big severe weather event, just looking out for some storms.
Well, what do you see if you look further into next week?
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and tell you this. Next week, models are agreeing that the central states are going to be wet again. So where we had that drought all fall and all winter, it's right now looking like it's really breaking down right before we get into our main growing season. And we want that in Illinois and in Indiana and Iowa and most of the Corn Belt, because that's moisture in the south central plains that gets basically recycled once we get into our growing season. So that's all good news.
Have you been looking at other models around the globe? For instance, does the EU model show something that might be of interest?
Yeah, it sure does. The European model, we just had the latest update of its longer range, what we call ensembles. And thing is, they're keeping the central plains wet for almost all of April. But this is what I'm getting concerned about now. The same model is also projecting that the southeast is going to be pretty dry and warm. And that generally to us signifies the development of a ridge over the southeast. Now, early in the season, it's something we watch. But if that ridge develops later in the year, it's good for corn, but bad for the southeast, which, you know, remember last year had a pretty nasty drought. What that ridge does is that builds in heat over the southeast. That hurts cotton, that hurts peanuts, but it drives a circulation around the edge of that ridge, which goes from Texas through the Great Plains into Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa, and gives us those ridge-riding thunderstorms. I will be watching for that all summer long.
All right. Hey, thanks so much. We appreciate you being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And, of course, Eric Snodgrass, he's with Agrible. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Support for WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey. As a Small Business Administration preferred lender, Busey partners with businesses and entrepreneurs who bring vibrancy to the community. Busey, your dream, our promise.
It's World Health Day and National Coffee Cake Day. The history of the coffee cake dates back to the ancient Egyptians. Precursors of modern cakes were first baked in Europe sometime in the mid-17th century. On this day in agricultural history in 1727, Michael Addison was born. Addison was a French biologist who developed a system of plant classification based on physical characteristics. In 1860, Will Keith Kellogg was born. He founded the Battle Creek Toasted Corn Flake Company to manufacture cereals developed by his brother, John Harvey Kellogg. In 1869, David Fairchild was born. He supervised the introduction of over 20,000 exotic plants and varieties of established crops into the U.S., including alfalfa and soya beans. He managed the Foreign Seed and Introduction Program of USDA for more than two decades, and he was author of The World Was My Garden and Exploring for Plants. In 1884, E.H. Sutton, an African-American inventor from North Carolina, patented a cotton cultivator. And in 1948, the World Health Organization was established. The WHO has more than 190 member nations. Its mission is the attainment by all peoples of the highest possible level of health, with an emphasis on infectious diseases. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Friday afternoon as we wrap up our time together in this first half hour of the program. For those of you who will be staying with us, Commodity Week is coming up next with John Bondurant, Dan Zwicker, and Chuck Shelby. Everybody else can pick that up online at willag.org in its entirety or tomorrow morning on many of these radio stations. But let's take some time now to think about the tax code as it relates to farmers making purchases to avoid taxes could be risking farmers for failure in the future. During a House Agriculture Committee hearing on tax reforms, ranking Democrat Colin Peterson of Minnesota cited a need for change, and he says current tax policies are leading producers to make similar choices as those made before the 1980s farm crisis.
When people would come in my office in December and they would ask me to figure out what their net income was, and then they would ask me how much equipment they had to buy so they wouldn't have to pay any tax. This is sometimes equipment they needed, but a lot of times it really wasn't. But, you know, they had a 7% tax credit at that time. And it was part of the reason people got in trouble in the farm crisis. My old partners tell me that they got the same situation going on now. As we get into this downturn in prices and pressure on agriculture producers, I think you're going to see people being in a more of a bind than they would have been because of what they did in the tax area.
One idea floated in the opening statements of the hearing was reconsidering the fair tax proposal, something previously supported by Peterson and Committee Chairman Mike Conaway.
Maybe we need to reenact or re-bring up the fair tax, which eliminates the income tax altogether, and it changes the incentive from buying things to get rid of tax to saving to get rid of tax. And that changes the whole mentality of, I was a co-sponsor of that for many years, but it kind of died by the wayside.
He says Congress needs to be careful in what reforms are made.
I think some of the ideas I've heard, getting rid of interest deductions as opposed to letting 100% expensing of all equipment and buildings, I got some real questions about that in terms of what it's going to do for agriculture. I think we need to be careful. This border adjustment tax, you know, sounds good, but could potentially collapse our export markets. And so we need to be really careful in what we do and be mindful of how this is going to impact agriculture and our producers.
Former Ag Committee member and now House Ways and Means Committee member Christy Noem, a Republican from South Dakota, says Ways and Means have discussed those concerns made by Representative Peterson.
Your concerns that you just expressed are some that we've debated in the Ways and Means meetings that we've had on tax reform as well, and that's one of the things that I've been grateful for is that I've been able to bring an agriculture perspective to those discussions, talk about the industry, how it is highly leveraged at times when producers are buying land with loans, then making loans to purchase machinery, then having an operating loan every year, too. We have to be careful what we do, that we keep their operations viable. So I appreciate you expressing those concerns, and we'll continue to work for a tax code that works for everybody.
Farm groups are calling on Congress to repeal the estate tax in any tax reforms, among many other issues. That wraps up this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to helping farm families succeed by offering financial products and services geared specifically to agriculture and rural communities, and developing partnership-based relationships with its member owners.